But Claudius, seeing that they were prepared for plunder and fearing that he might die by the same violence as Gaius, begged them to spare him, reminding them of how inoffensive he had been and how he had taken no forethought for what had happened. Gratus, smiling, took hold of his right hand and said, "Stop being petty about your safety. You ought instead to be thinking grandly about the rule which the gods, having taken it from Gaius, have granted to your virtue, having taken thought for the world. Come then, and take up the throne of your ancestors." And they lifted him up, since he was scarcely able to walk on his own feet, from both fear and joy at what had been said. More and more of the bodyguards now gathered around Gratus, and seeing Claudius being led away, they thought he was being dragged off to punishment for the losses he had suffered. A man who had lived his whole life inoffensively and had faced no small dangers during the reign of Gaius. Some of them thought it right to hand his case over to the consuls for judgment. As more and more of the soldiery gathered, the crowd began to scatter, and there was no way forward for Claudius because of his physical weakness, since even the men carrying his litter, when the flight broke out around the moment of his seizure, saved themselves, giving up hope for their master's safety. When they reached the open space of the Palatine, which, tradition tells us, was the first part of the city of Rome to be inhabited, and were already laying hold of the public quarter, the crowd of soldiers flocking to them grew much larger, welcoming the sight of Claudius with joy, and they were most eager to set the man up as emperor, both out of goodwill toward Germanicus, whose brother he was and who had left behind, for all who had known him, a memory greatly to his credit. A further consideration occurred to them too, the greed of those who held power in the Senate and all the wrongs committed under the former administration. Besides, they took note of the impracticality of the whole business and reflected that if power reverted once more to a single ruler, the dangers to them would come through the one man who had won it, whoever should be granted it. Whereas if by their goodwill Claudius took it, he would remember the favor and repay them with honor sufficient for such a service. These thoughts they turned over among themselves and privately, and told to everyone they met along the way, and those who heard readily accepted the proposal, and closing ranks and pressing in around him, they carried him on their shoulders to the camp, so that their haste might not be hindered. Meanwhile, opinion was divided among the people and among the senators. Some, who longed for their former dignity and were eager to seize the moment to escape from the slavery that the insolence of tyrants had imposed on them, hoped that the seizure of Claudius would spare them civil strife of the kind that had once occurred under Pompey, if this man were established as emperor. The people, on the other hand, out of envy toward the Senate, and knowing that emperors served as a check on its greed, and as their own refuge, rejoiced at Claudius's seizure. When the Senate learned that Claudius had been brought to the camp by the soldiers, it sent to him men of distinction from its own number, who were to instruct him that he must not use force to hold onto power, but should yield to the Senate, since he was but one man among so many, giving way, and, in accordance with the law, surrendering to it the oversight of public affairs. That he should remember what the earlier tyrants had done to harm the city, and what dangers he himself had run together with the senators under Gaius, and that he should not, because he hated the oppressiveness of the tyranny practiced by others, take courage of his own accord to commit the same outrage against his country. If he obeyed, he would be assured lasting honors, such as free citizens would vote him, and by the law's concession, both ruler and ruled would gain the credit of virtuous conduct. But if he grew reckless, learning nothing from the death of Gaius, they themselves would certainly not permit it, for their forces were considerable, they had an abundance of arms, and a multitude of slaves who could be made use of. Fortune and hope, moreover, counted for much, and the gods gave their aid not to just anyone, but to those who conducted their struggles with virtue and honor. And such, they said, were those who fought for the freedom of their country. The envoys, Vernius and Bracchus, both of whom were tribunes, delivered this message, and falling at his knees, they implored him earnestly not to plunge the city into war and calamity, seeing that Claudius was already surrounded by a great mass of soldiers, and that the consuls counted for nothing beside him. If he desired power, let him accept it as given by the Senate, for it was a happier and more prosperous thing to receive rule not through violence, but through the good will of those who granted it. Claudius, knowing full well with what boldness they had been sent, for the present turned toward greater moderation in line with their wishes. Yet, roused both by fear on their account and by the confidence of the soldiers, and by King Agrippa's urging that he not let slip from his hands so great a power that had come to him unbidden, he acted as one would expect a man to act who had been raised to honor by Gaius himself. For he had taken charge of Gaius's corpse, laid it out on a bier, dressed it as decently as circumstances allowed, and withdrawn to the bodyguards, announcing that Gaius was alive, though suffering from his wounds, and saying that physicians would come to him. But on learning of Claudius's seizure by the soldiers, he hurried to him, and finding him in confusion and ready to yield to the Senate, he roused him to lay claim instead to the rule. Having said this to Claudius, he went over to his side. And when the Senate summoned him back, he anointed his head with perfumes, as though he were just returning from some social gathering, and appeared before them, and they asked him what Claudius had done. When he told them the truth and they further inquired what view he held about the whole situation, he was ready in words to die for the Senate's honor. But he bade them consider, apart from what gave them pleasure, whatever served their advantage. For those who aspired to power needed both arms and soldiers to defend them, lest, being unprepared, they should come to grief in this venture. When the Senate answered that it would supply an abundance of arms and money, and that it already had part of an army assembled, the rest to be raised by freeing slaves, "It would be possible, senators," said Agrippa, taking up the matter, "to do whatever your spirit prompts, but I must say, without hesitation, since my words are spoken for your safety. You know that the army fighting for Claudius has long practice in soldiering, whereas our forces will be a motley crowd, including those unexpectedly freed from slavery, and hard to control. We shall be fighting trained men after putting forward men who do not even know how to draw a sword. It seems to me, therefore, that we should send envoys to persuade Claudius to lay down his power, and I am ready myself to go on such an embassy." So he spoke, and when they agreed, he was sent along with others. And privately he described to Claudius the Senate's turmoil and instructed him to answer in a more commanding manner, befitting the dignity of his authority. Claudius accordingly said that he was not surprised the Senate took no pleasure in being ruled, worn out as it was by the cruelty of those who had previously held power, but that they would find in him, by his own moderate conduct, a taste of better times. The name of rule alone would belong to him, while in practice it would be set forth for the common good of all. Having traveled through many and varied circumstances, he said it was well for them, in his presence, not to distrust him. And the envoys, charmed by hearing such words, were sent on their way. Claudius then addressed the assembled army, taking oaths from them that they would surely remain faithful to him, and gave the bodyguards 5,000 drachmas apiece, promising proportionate sums to their officers according to rank, and the same to the legions wherever stationed. Meanwhile, the consuls called the Senate together in the temple of Jupiter the Victorious. It was still night. Of the senators, some who were hiding themselves in the city hesitated to attend the meeting, while others, who had gone out to their own estates, had already made their exit, foreseeing how the whole matter would turn out, now that hope of freedom had been abandoned, and judging it far better to live out their lives safely in idleness rather than in labor, than to gain the rank of their fathers only to remain in doubt about their own safety. Even so, no more than 100 assembled, and while they were deliberating about the matters at hand, a sudden shout rose up from the soldiery gathered together, bidding the Senate choose an emperor as commander and not ruin the government through a multiplicity of rulers. And for their own part, they declared that power should belong not to all, but to one man, and that it was for the senators to see who was worthy of so great a charge. So the senators were in great distress, chiefly through shame at their boast of freedom having come to nothing, but also through fear of Claudius. There were, nonetheless, some who aspired to power, both by the distinction of their birth and by marriage connections. Minucianus, for instance, put forward Marcus, a man of note in his own right for his nobility, who had also married Julia, the sister of Gaius, and who was eager to lay claim to power. But the consuls held him back, contriving one pretext after another. Minucianus also restrained Valerius Asiaticus, one of the assassins of Gaius, from entertaining such designs. There would have been a slaughter no less than what had already occurred. Had those who desired power been allowed free rein to set themselves against Claudius, all the more since the gladiators, of whom there was a considerable number, and those soldiers who kept night watch over the city, and as many oarsmen as were streaming into the camp, were involved, so that of those seeking power, some withdrew out of regard for the city, others out of fear for themselves. At the very beginning of the day, Caria and those with him came forward and made an attempt at persuasion, addressing the soldiers. But when the crowd saw them silencing the men with gestures and refusing to allow them to say what they were capable of urging as to who should rule, they raised an uproar, since all were bent on having a monarchy, and called for the man who was to lead them, unwilling to tolerate delay. The Senate, meanwhile, was at a loss both as to who should rule and in what manner it should be ruled, since the soldiers would not accept them, and the assassins of Gaius would not permit the soldiers to have their way. In such circumstances, Caria, unable to contain his anger at the demand for an emperor, promised to give them a general if someone would bring him a signal from Eutychus. This Eutychus was a charioteer of the faction called the Greens, greatly favored by Gaius, and much occupied about the stable buildings of that faction's horses. The soldiery was worn out with these degrading duties. It was for this that Caria reproached them, along with much else of the sort, adding that he would fetch the head of Claudius himself. It would be monstrous if, after one madman, they handed the command to a fool. His words did not move them at all. Instead, they drew their swords, took up their standards, and went off to join those swearing allegiance to Claudius. The Senate was left without defenders, and the consuls were no better off than private citizens. Shock and despondency filled them, and no one knew what to do with the conspirators, since Claudius had been provoked against them. They turned to abusing one another, and regret set in. Sabinus, one of Gaius' assassins, came forward and threatened to kill himself before he would see Claudius established as ruler and slavery take hold. He rebuked Caria for clinging to life, if, having despised Gaius, he was now the first to judge life more valuable than a freedom that could no longer be restored to the fatherland in any case. Caria replied that he had no hesitation about dying, but wished first to test Claudius' intentions. So matters stood with them. Meanwhile, at the camp, crowds pressed in from every side to pay their respects. One of the consuls, Quintus Pomponius, was under suspicion by the soldiers, since he was urging the Senate on toward freedom. They drew their swords and would have acted against him had Claudius not intervened. Claudius seated the consul beside himself, rescuing him from danger, but the other senators who were with Quintus were not received with the same honor. Some were even struck as they were pushed back from access to him. Apponius withdrew wounded, and all of them were in danger. King Agrippa then came forward to Claudius and asked him to deal more gently with the senators, for if any harm came to the Senate, he would have no one else left to rule. Claudius yielded and summoned the Senate to the Palatine, being carried there through the city escorted by the soldiery, with a great deal of rough handling of the crowd along the way. Among the assassins of Gaius, Caria and Sabinus went out more openly, though they were barred from public appearances by the letters of Pollio, whom Claudius had shortly before chosen as commander of the bodyguard. When Claudius reached the Palatine, he gathered his companions and put Caria's case to a vote. To them, the deed itself seemed splendid, but they charged the man who had done it with treachery and thought it right to impose punishment on him as a deterrent for the future. So he was led away to execution, and with him Lupus and a good number of other Romans. It is said that Caria bore his misfortune with great composure, his bearing unshaken throughout, in contrast to Lupus, whom he taunted for breaking into tears. When Lupus, laying aside his cloak, complained of the cold, Caria remarked that Lupus had never before shrunk from acting against the cold. As a crowd of onlookers followed to watch, when he reached the place, he asked the soldier whether the killing blows had come to him with practice, or whether he now held a sword for the first time, and told him to bring the very blade with which he himself had dispatched Gaius. He died fortunate, killed with a single stroke. Lupus, however, did not manage his end so gracefully. He shrank back in distress, and it took several blows, since he offered his neck too weakly. A few days later, when the Romans were holding their rites for the dead, the people brought their offerings to the fire and honored Caria's portion among them as well, praying that he be gracious and free of resentment for the ingratitude shown him. Such was the end of Caria's life. As for Sabinus, though Claudius released him not only from the charge, but restored to him the office he had held, he considered it wrong to abandon his pledge to his fellow conspirators, and killed himself by falling on his sword until the hilt itself met the wound. Claudius, having swiftly cleared away everything suspect in the army, published an edict confirming the kingdom Gaius had granted Agrippa and praising the king with high commendation. He added to it the whole territory that had been ruled by Herod, Agrippa's grandfather, Judea and Samaria, restoring this as a debt owed to their kinship. He further added Abila, the territory of Lysanias, and all that lay on Mount Lebanon that had belonged to it, and a treaty was sworn between them in the middle of the forum in the city of Rome. He took from Antiochus the kingdom he held and gave him instead a portion of Cilicia, along with Commagene. He also freed Alexander the Alabac, an old friend of his, and Antonius Steward, who had been bound in chains through Gaius' anger, and Alexander's son married Berenice, Agrippa's daughter. As for that marriage, since Marcus, Alexander's son, died after having taken her as a virgin bride, Agrippa gave her to his own brother Herod, having asked Claudius that he be granted the kingdom of Chalcis. At about this same time, discord broke out between the Jews and the Greeks in the city of Alexandria. For after the death of Gaius, the Jewish nation, which under his rule had been humbled and grievously insulted by the Alexandrians, took heart again and was immediately in arms. Claudius wrote to the prefect governing Egypt to put down the uprising, and he also sent an edict, at the urging of the kings Agrippa and Herod, to both Alexandria and Syria, written in the following terms: Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, holder of tribunician power, declares: Having learned that the Jews in Alexandria, called Alexandrians, were settled together with the earliest inhabitants from the very first times of the city, and obtained equal citizenship from the kings, as is clear from the documents in their possession and from the decrees, and that after Alexandria was brought under our rule by Augustus, their rights were preserved by the successive prefects sent out, and that no dispute over these rights had arisen, and further, that at the time when Aquila was in Alexandria, upon the death of the ethnarch of the Jews, Augustus did not prevent further ethnarchs from being appointed, wishing that each people remain subject while abiding by its own customs and not be compelled to transgress their ancestral religion, but that the Alexandrians grew emboldened against the Jews among them in the time of Gaius Caesar, on account of his great derangement and madness. Because the Jewish nation refused to transgress its ancestral religion and address him as a god, and so he humbled them, I wish that none of the rights of the Jewish nation be forfeited on account of Gaius' madness, but that their former privileges be preserved for them so long as they abide by their own customs, and I charge both parties to take the greatest care that no disturbance arise after the publication of my edict. Such, then, was the wording of the edict sent to Alexandria on behalf of the Jews. The one sent to the rest of the inhabited world read as follows: Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, high priest, holder of tribunician power, chosen consul for the second time, declares: Since King Agrippa and King Herod, dearest to me, have asked that I grant the same rights to be preserved for the Jews throughout the whole empire under Roman rule as for those in Alexandria, I have most gladly agreed, not only as a favor to those who asked it of me, but because I judge those on whose behalf the request was made to be worthy of it, on account of their loyalty and friendship toward the Romans. I judge it especially just that no Greek city be denied these rights, since they were preserved for them even in the time of the deified Augustus. It is therefore right that the Jews throughout the whole world under our rule keep their ancestral customs without hindrance, and I now charge them in turn to make more moderate use of this kindness of mine, and not to hold in contempt the religious observances of other nations, but to keep their own laws. I wish this edict of mine to be published by the magistrates of the cities and colonies and municipalities in Italy and abroad, and by kings and rulers through their own envoys, and to be kept posted for no fewer than 30 days, in a place where it can easily be read from ground level. By these edicts, sent to Alexandria, and to the whole inhabited world, Claudius Caesar made known his mind concerning the Jews. He then at once sent Agrippa off to take possession of his kingdom, with even greater honors, writing to the governors and procurators of the provinces to treat him with affection. Agrippa, as one would expect of a man returning to a better fortune, hastened back, and coming to Jerusalem, he offered thanksgiving sacrifices, omitting nothing that the law required. For this reason, he also ordered a great many Nazarites to be shaved. The golden chain that Gaius had given him, equal in weight to the iron one with which his royal hands had been bound, he hung up within the sacred precincts above the treasury, as a memorial of his wretched fortune and a testimony to his change for the better, so that it might stand as proof both that great things can sometimes fall, and that God can raise up what has fallen. For the dedication of the chain made this plain to all, that King Agrippa, from a small cause, had been stripped of his former dignity and become a prisoner, and shortly afterward, released from his fetters, had been raised to a kingship more splendid than before. From this, then, one should reflect that human greatness can slip and fall, and that what has been brought low can rise again to conspicuous heights. Having thus fully paid his devotions to God, Agrippa removed Theophilus, son of Ananus, from the high priesthood, and bestowed that honor on Simon, son of Boethus, who bore the surname Cantharas. Simon had two brothers, and their father was Boethus, whose daughter King Herod had married, as has been shown above. So Simon held the priesthood along with his brothers and his father, just as before him the three sons of Simon, son of Onias, had held it together in the time of the Macedonian rule, as we have related in earlier books. Having thus arranged matters concerning the high priests, the king repaid the people of Jerusalem for their goodwill toward him. He remitted the tax due on every house, thinking it fitting to return affection for the affection they had shown him. He appointed Silas commander of the whole army, a man who had shared many hardships with him. A very short time later, some young men of Dora, putting forward boldness in place of piety and naturally inclined to reckless daring, brought a statue of Caesar and set it up in the synagogue of the Jews. This greatly provoked Agrippa, for it amounted to an overthrow of his ancestral laws. Without delay, he went to Publius Petronius, who was governor of Syria, and denounced the men of Dora. Petronius, no less angered at what had been done, for he too judged the transgression of the laws to be impiety, wrote in anger to the leading men of Dora who had committed the offense. Publius Petronius, legate of Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, declares to the chief men of Dora, "Since some among you have shown such reckless folly that, even though the edict of Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus permitting the Jews to observe their ancestral customs had been published, you were not persuaded to obey it, but did the very opposite, preventing the Jews from holding their assembly by moving Caesar's statue into it, thereby transgressing not only against the Jews, but against the emperor himself, whose statue would better be set up in his own temple than in another's, and especially in the place of the synagogue, since nature grants each people the right to govern its own place, in accordance with Caesar's decree, for it is absurd to invoke my own decree after the emperor's own edict, which permitted the Jews to keep their own customs, and, further, to share citizenship with the Greeks. As for those who dared such things against the Augustan edict, since even those of you who seem to hold the highest standing among you were themselves indignant, saying that it was not done by their own choice, but by the impulse of the crowd, I have ordered them brought before me by the centurion Proculus Vitellius to give an account of what was done. And I urge the chief magistrates, if they do not wish this wrongdoing to appear to have been done by their own choice, to point out the guilty parties to the centurion, and to allow no occasion for sedition or conflict, which I suspect is exactly what is being sought through such acts. Since neither I nor King Agrippa, whom I hold in the highest honor, care about anything more than that the Jewish nation, gathering under the pretext of self-defense, should not be driven by some such occasion into open desperation. And so that it may be better known what view Augustus himself took of this whole matter, I have attached his edicts published at Alexandria, which, even though they are thought to be known to all, King Agrippa, whom I hold in the highest honor, nevertheless read publicly from the tribunal, pleading that they ought not to be deprived of Augustus' gift. For the future, then, I charge you to seek no pretext for sedition or disturbance, but to let each people practice its own rights. Thus Petronius took care that the wrong already done should be set right, and that nothing similar should happen to them again. King Agrippa removed Simon Cantharas from the high priesthood and restored it once more to Jonathan, son of Ananus, judging him more deserving of the honor. but it did not seem to Jonathan a welcome thing to receive so great an honor, and he declined it, saying, "I rejoice, O king, in the honor you have shown me, holding dear in my soul this favor which your goodwill grants me, but God has not judged me worthy of the high priesthood at all. Having once put on the sacred vestments, I am content, for I wore them then with greater holiness than I would recover now. But if you wish someone more worthy than myself to receive this honor now, let me instruct you. My brother is pure of all sin, both toward God and toward you, O king. I recommend him as fitting for the honor." Pleased with these words, the king admired Jonathan for his judgment and gave the priesthood to his brother Matthias. Not long after, Marsus succeeded Petronius and took charge of Syria. And the king Silas? Silas, the king's prefect, had remained loyal to him through every turn of fortune, refusing no danger and often undertaking the most hazardous labors on his behalf, and he was full of a confidence that he thought entitled him to equal standing on the strength of that steadfast friendship. He would therefore never defer to the king in any way, but spoke his mind freely on every occasion. And in his displays of familiarity, he became tiresome, boasting of himself without measure and repeatedly bringing up before the king the grim turns of his former fortune, calling them to mind so as to point out his own zeal at the time, and constantly recounting, at length, how much he had toiled on the king's behalf. The excess of these reminders came to seem an insult, and so the king came to resent the man's unchecked frankness of speech, for the memories of inglorious times are not pleasant, and it is foolish to keep bringing up favors one has done in the past. In the end, Silas so thoroughly provoked the king's anger that Agrippa, giving way to rage more than to reason, not only removed him from his prefecture, but had him bound and sent back, to be imprisoned, in his own homeland. In time, however, the king's anger cooled, and turning the matter over with a clearer judgment, he took into account how many labors the man had endured on his behalf. So when he was celebrating his own birthday, a day on which all his subjects held festivities in general rejoicing, he summoned Silas at once to come and share his table. But Silas, for his temper, was that of a free man, thought he had good cause for anger, and did not conceal it, saying to those who came for him, "For what honor is the king recalling me, an honor that will vanish again in a moment? He did not even preserve for me the rewards I first earned for my goodwill toward him, he stripped them from me with insult. Or does he suppose I have given up my frankness of speech? With what conscience could I keep silent, when I could cry aloud instead how many dangers I freed him from, how many labors I bore to secure his safety, and his honor labors for which my reward was chains and a dark prison cell? I will never forget these things. Perhaps even my soul, once it has left the flesh, will carry with it the memory of my valor." This is what he shouted, and what he ordered be reported to the king. The king, seeing that he was incurably disposed in this way, again left him in confinement. He fortified the walls of Jerusalem on the side facing the new part of the city at public expense, widening them in some places and raising them higher in others, and he would have carried this work to a scale beyond any human power to overcome, had not Marsus, the governor of Syria, informed Claudius Caesar by letter of what was being done. Claudius, suspecting some plan of revolution, sent orders to Agrippa to stop the building of the walls at once, and Agrippa judged it best not to disobey. This king was by nature inclined to generosity in his gifts, ambitious to show magnanimity toward nations, and delighted to raise himself to prominence through lavish and repeated expenditures, taking pleasure in giving and rejoicing to live amid good report in temperament nothing like Herod, the king before him. For Herod's character was harsh, given to severe punishment, and unrestrained toward those he hated, and it is acknowledged that he was more closely attached to the Greeks than to the Jews. He adorned the cities of foreigners with gifts of money, with the construction of baths and theaters, and in some he even raised temples, in others colonnades, but he never deemed any city of the Jews worthy even of the slightest repair, nor of any gift worth mentioning. Agrippa's temperament, by contrast, was gentle, and his generosity was shown alike to all. Toward foreigners he was kindly and displayed his liberality to them as well, but toward his own people he was proportionately more benevolent and sympathetic. He took pleasure, at any rate, in residing continually in Jerusalem, and he kept the ancestral customs in strict purity, living his whole life in a state of ritual cleanness, letting no day pass without its lawful sacrifices being offered. Now there was a certain man in Jerusalem, a native who was reputed to be a strict observer of the law. His name was Simon, who gathered a crowd into an assembly at a time when the king had gone away to Caesarea, and dared to denounce him, saying that he was not pure, and that he would justly be barred from entering the temple, since that right belonged to the native-born. This speech of Simon's before the populace was reported to the king by the commander of the city's garrison, in a letter. The king summoned Simon, and since he happened to be sitting in the theater at the time, he ordered him to be seated beside him. "Tell me, gently and calmly," he said, "what is unlawful in the things that go on here?" Simon had nothing to say and begged to be forgiven. The king was reconciled to him more readily than anyone expected, judging mildness more befitting a king than anger, and knowing that in the great, forbearance is more fitting than rage. So he even honored Simon with a gift before sending him away. Having built many things in many places, he honored the people of Beirut in particular, for he built them a theater surpassing many others in costliness and beauty, and an amphitheater built at great expense, and besides these, baths and colonnades, sparing no expense in any of these works and doing no injury either to their beauty or their scale. He was equally lavish in the magnificence of their dedication, presenting in the theater spectacles of every kind of musical performance and every form of varied entertainment for the pleasure of the crowd, and in the amphitheater displaying his own munificence through a multitude of gladiators. There, wishing to stage a mass combat for the pleasure of the spectators, he sent in 700 men to fight 700 others, assigning to this task all the criminals he had, so that they might be punished while, at the same time, the work of war became, in peacetime, a form of entertainment. These men he destroyed to the last one. Having completed the events described at Beirut, he moved on to Tiberias, a city of Galilee. He had by now come to be regarded with admiration by the other kings. Antiochus, king of Commagene, came to visit him, as did Sampsigeramus, king of Emesa and Codes, who ruled Lesser Armenia and Polemon, who held the kingdom of Pontus, and Herod, his own brother, who ruled Chalcis. He entertained them all, in his receptions and displays of friendliness, in a manner that showed the very height of good judgment, so much so that it seemed only just that he should be honored by the presence of the king. But while these men were still lingering with him, Marsus, the governor of Syria, arrived. The king, observing due respect toward the Romans, went out 7 stadia from the city to meet him. But this, as it turned out, was to be the beginning of his falling out with Marsus. For as he sat beside him in his carriage, he had brought the other kings along with him. And Marsus, seeing their unity and mutual friendship extending even this far, suspected it and judged it not in Rome's interest for so many rulers to be of one mind together. He therefore at once sent men to each of them privately, instructing them to depart to their own territories without delay. Agrippa took this badly, and from that time his relations with Marsus were strained. He also removed Matthias from the high priesthood and appointed in his place Ilioneus, son of Citharus, as high priest. The 3rd year of his reign over the whole of Judea had now been completed, and he came to the city of Caesarea, which had formerly been called Strato's Tower. There he presented spectacles in honor of Caesar, understanding this to be a festival held for his welfare, and a great number of the province's officials and men risen to high rank had gathered for the occasion. On the 2nd day of the spectacles, he put on a robe woven entirely of silver, of such marvelous workmanship that it was a wonder to behold, and entered the theater at the break of day. There, as the first rays of the sun struck it, the silver, catching the light, shone out in a way that was astonishing, gleaming with a brilliance that struck those who gazed at him with something like fear and dread. At once the flatterers, though it did him no good, cried out from this side and that, calling him a god and saying, "Be gracious to us. If until now we have feared you as a man, from this time on we confess you to be greater than mortal nature." The king did not rebuke them for this, nor did he reject their impious flattery. But shortly afterward, looking up, he saw an owl perched above his head on a rope. He recognized at once that this was a messenger of evil, just as it had once been a messenger of good things, and a sharp pain seized his heart, and at the same moment a violent, sudden agony fastened on his bowels. Turning to his friends, he cried out, I, whom you call a god, am now ordered to end my life fate, at once proving false the words you just now spoke falsely of me. I, who was called immortal by you, am even now being led away to die. But I must accept my destiny, as God has willed it, for we have lived our life in no mean fashion, but amid a splendor that has been called blessed. Even as he spoke these words, he was overcome by the intensifying pain, and he was carried in haste to the palace, and word spread among all the people that he was on the point of death altogether. At once the multitude, together with their wives and children, sat down on sackcloth, according to ancestral custom, and prayed to God on the king's behalf, and everything was full of wailing and lamentation. The king, lying in a lofty chamber and looking down at them falling prostrate below, could not himself hold back his own tears. After 5 continuous days of being racked by the pain in his belly, he ended his life, being in the 54th year of his age and the 7th of his reign. He had reigned 4 years under Gaius Caesar, ruling the Tetrarchy of Philip for 3 years, and in the 4th, receiving in addition that of Herod. And he had held it for 3 years more under the rule of Claudius Caesar, during which he reigned over the territories already named, and also received in addition Judea, Samaria, and Caesarea. The revenue he drew from these came to as much as 12 million drachmas, and yet he borrowed heavily besides, for being so generous he spent more lavishly than his income allowed, since his love of honor knew no restraint. While the news of his death was still unknown to the populace, Herod, ruler of Chalcis, and Helcias the prefect, a friend of the king, conspiring together, sent Aristo, one of their suitable attendants, and had Silas, for he was their enemy, put to death, as though by order of the king. Thus did King Agrippa end his life in this manner. He left behind him a son, Agrippa, 17 years of age, and 3 daughters. Of these, Berenice, aged 16, had already been married to Herod, her father's brother, while the other two, Mariam and Drusilla, were still unmarried, the one being 10 years old and Drusilla 6. Their father had betrothed them in marriage, Mariam to Julius Archelaus, son of Chalcis, and Drusilla to Epiphanes, son of Antiochus, king of Comagene. But when it became known that Agrippa had departed this life, the people of Caesarea and Sebaste, forgetting his benefactions, behaved like the bitterest of enemies. They hurled unseemly abuse at the departed king, and those among them who happened at the time to be under arms, and they were many, went home, seized the statues of the king's daughters, carried them off together to the brothels, set them up on the rooftops, and abused them there in ways too indecent to describe, so far as it was possible. They also reclined in the public squares and held communal banquets, crowned with wreaths and anointed with myrrh, pouring libations to Charon and drinking toasts to one another over the king's death. They forgot not only Agrippa, who had shown them many acts of generosity, but also his grandfather Herod, who had built their cities for them and constructed harbors and temples at magnificent expense. Meanwhile, the son of the deceased, also named Agrippa, was at this time in Rome, being raised at the court of Claudius Caesar. When Caesar learned that Agrippa had died, and that the people of Sebaste and Caesarea had committed outrages against him, he grieved for the one and was angered at the ingratitude of the other. He was on the point of at once sending the younger Agrippa to succeed to the kingdom, wishing also to make good the oaths he had sworn. But the freedmen and friends who held the greatest influence with him dissuaded him, saying it was altogether risky to entrust so great a kingdom to one so young, who had not even outgrown the years of boyhood, since he would be unable to bear the burdens of administration, and that even for a grown man a kingdom is a heavy weight to carry. Caesar judged that they spoke reasonably, and so he sent Cuspius Fadus as prefect over Judea and the whole kingdom, thereby paying honor to the deceased by not bringing in Marsus, with whom Agrippa had been at odds, to rule over his kingdom. He had also resolved, before anything else, to instruct Fadus to rebuke the people of Caesarea and Sebaste for their outrages against the dead king and their drunken abuse of those still living, and to transfer the cavalry regiment of the Caesarians and Sebastines, together with the 5 cohorts, to Pontus, so that they might serve there, and to select soldiers from the Roman legions in Syria by number to fill their place. But those so ordered did not move, for by sending envoys they mollified Claudius and obtained leave to remain in Judea. And it was these very men who, in the times that followed, became the source of the greatest calamities for the Jews, sowing the seeds of the war that would come under Florus, from which cause Vespasian, once he had prevailed, as we shall relate shortly, removed them from the province.